Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 834, Compendium on Fascist Connections to the Zionist Movement. This is being recorded on February 8th of the year 2015. With the upcoming visit of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is bypassing normal protocol and is going to be addressing Congress at the invitation of House Speaker John Boehner, bypassing Barack Obama, I thought that it would be worth discussing some of the political and historical background of Benjamin Netanyahu and his Likud party. Benjamin Netanyahu, I should say, is, as we have looked at in past programs, is a political ally of, among others, Mitt Romney, who in turn, by the way, is a political ally of Ron Paul, although Ron Paul does not like to talk about that. In this program, we are going to be introducing some new information or information we have not covered at great length, and we are going to be digging back in the archives, going back to 1983, to talk about some of the very real and very well-documented links between the Zionist movement or elements of the Zionist movement and international fascism, in particular Mussolini's Italy and elements of Nazi Germany and even the SS. Now, this the subject of Israel and Zionism and the conflict between the Arabs and Israel is one that is not only poorly understood but generally misrepresented. And above all else, it is so charged with blind emotion that it is not a pleasant thing to talk about. I do not want to be misunderstood as saying that either Israel or the Zionist movement is fascist. That is simply not true. And beyond that, it is politically and historically illiterate, although much of the rhetoric coming out of both the far right and the so-called progressive sector, which, by the way, is merging to a large extent with the far right, has that to be the case. We haven't got time to even begin to sum up the history of the Zionist movement and the development of the State of Israel and the conflict between Israel and the Arabs. It goes back to World War I, and before that, you'd have to talk about the cynical realpolitik of the British and Ottoman empires in their dying phases, and the tripartite doctrine that was used first by the Ottoman Empire and then by the British with regard to the Nashashibi, the Husseini, and the Hashemite clans. And people know nothing about that. You talk about Hashemites to the average so-called progressive, they think you're talking about a cannabis user. And if you talk about the Ottoman Empire to the average American, they'll think you're talking about a retail furniture outlet. So it is against that background of venal rhetoric and ignorance that I am undertaking this. Suffice it to say that, particularly in its inception, much, perhaps most, of the Zionist movement was actually socialist, not fascist at all. And as far as some of the idiocy that has been disseminated about Israel, the notion, for example, that is often generated, comparing Israel with the Nazis, particularly after the Gaza Wars, is simply asinine. By way of example, one brigade of the Leibstandarte Adolf Hitler, the 1st Waffen-SS Division, under the command of General Jochen Peiper, a brigade of that of Waffen-SS at that point in time would have been about 7,000 men. They burned 200 villages in the former Soviet Union with the people locked in the buildings. There is simply no basis for comparison between what the Nazis did and the Israelis. If the Israelis were pursuing Nazi policies, the Palestinians would all be dead. And certainly Israel has the capability of doing that. Also, talking about Israel being fascist, just by way of example, gay soldiers of both genders in the Israeli Defense Forces get full spousal rights for their live-in partners. in much of the Arab world, gays, are regarded in the same light as clitorises. If you find one, get rid of it. And as far as the cheesy rhetoric comparing Israel with apartheid South Africa, suffice it to say, for example, and this is something of a pivot point, a couple of years ago when former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was convicted on corruption charges, one of the judges who sat in judgment on his case was an Israeli Muslim Arab. The rhetoric and the knowledge is so poorly informed that there is no effective distinction made between Palestinians and Israeli Muslim Arabs, and that is a fundamental distinction. That is something of a pivot point. Again, talking about Israel as an apartheid state is just asinine and historically illiterate. There were no black judges in apartheid South Africa sitting in judgment on white politicians, and that's just ridiculous. However, that having been said, there is, and almost from the beginning has been, a fascist element within the Zionist movement, which has grown more powerful. Benjamin Netanyahu and his Likud party are the direct heirs to that. And as I noted, comparing Israel to the apartheid South Africa is asinine. However, Netanyahu has introduced a piece of legislation that will declare Israel to be a, quote, Jewish state, unquote. Well, the fact of the matter is that Israel is not a, quote, Jewish state. It is a primarily Jewish state with a sizable Israeli Muslim Arab minority. And those Israeli Muslim Arabs arguably enjoy more political and civil liberties than Arabs anywhere else in that part of the world. They do very well for themselves. Not to say there aren't tensions. They're most assured they are. But again, when you have judges and educators in Israel who are Israeli Muslim Arabs, it just dissolves that consideration. However, by proposing that legislation, which, by the way, has caused a great deal of controversy in Israel and actually led to the dissolution of Netanyahu's parliamentary coalition. There are upcoming elections. That is in and of itself a bigoted resolution. And if I were an Israeli Muslim Arab, I would resent the living hell out of that. Beyond that, one of the tenets of the revisionist Zionists, founded by Vladimir Jabotinsky, is that basically much of the Middle East is biblically willed, so to speak, to the Jews and Israel. I simply don't buy that at all. And I would note, for example, an interesting question that the world Zionist and Jewish communities face is just exactly whether or not the Israeli right wing, which has a fascist heritage, as we're about to see, is able to dictate policy to the world's Jewry. For example, a couple of years ago, maybe about a year, year and a half ago, a poll was taken of American Jews, who are the second largest Jewish community in the world, of whether or not they supported the expansion of settlements in the West Bank. And less than 16% of respondents said they were supportive of those settlements. That is fewer than one in six. So another of the questions that looms here is, will the fascist slash reactionary elements of the Zionist movement, and Netanyahu is the heir to that, will they be able to dictate policy to the rest of Israel and beyond that to the world Jewish community? Now, going into some of the documentation, there are a couple of articles here talking about the death of Ben Zion Netanyahu, a former professor at Princeton University and a man who was the personal secretary to Ze'ev Nev Vladimir Jabotinsky, the head of the Beitar. One article from Time magazine of May 2nd of 2012 by Carl Vick, V-I-C-K, received wisdom, how the ideology of Netanyahu's late father influenced the son. Skipping down, we read, in recent decades, Israeli politics came to be dominated by the Likud, The party founded on the philosophy of Zaev Jabotinsky, the man Benjamin Netanyahu went to America to serve as secretary and whose vision he carried on after Jabotinsky's death. The ideology called for a greater Israel, unquote, that stretched not only across the West Bank, but even across what is today Jordan, land regarded as promised to the Jews in the views of revisionist Zionism, as the movement was known. It was a robust, even militaristic movement that called for an iron wall, unquote, between the newly founded state and the Arabs surrounding it. What we're going to do is to talk about the history of the Beitar, which morphed into the Likud party, and bear in mind that Netanyahu's father was the personal secretary to Vladimir Jabotinsky. We're going to dig back into the archives to September of 1983, and we're going to listen to a portion of Miscellaneous Archive Show M30 about fascist Zionist connections. This, in turn, accesses an article by the late Alexander Coburn from October of 1982. By the way, I don't think Coburn's overall take on Israel is particularly intelligent, but he is accurate in his portrayal of the events that you are about to hear. Again, an excerpt from Miscellaneous Archive Show M30 from September of 1983.
Alexander Coburn writing from the Village Voice of October 12th, 1982. For one of his recent reports from Israel for the New York Times, David Shipler interviewed the excellent Israeli journalist Amos Elon, last name E-L-O-N, and quoted Elon as referring to the Jewish face of fascism, unquote. He even tucked away at the end of the article, the use of the phrase was striking and brought to mind at once an uproar in August when I quoted here a famous letter to the New York Times signed by Albert Einstein, Hannah Arendt, and others protesting Begin's trip to the United States in 1948 and calling him and his party fascist. I was accused by Saul Stern of fascist baiting in these pages for citing the letter. So lest I be accused one day of shirking response to this charge, let us consider the background of the letter signed by Einstein et al. The ideology of Begin, his associates in the 1930s then thereafter, and the bulk of the revisionist movement within Zionism is a murky business. Until 1977, Begin was generally regarded as being on the lunatic fringe of Zionism, and after that date, he was rapidly liberated via Camp David and the Nobel Prize from the distasteful political and philosophical vestments of an earlier time. Einstein's attacks on Begin's fascism did not start in 1948, nor was it a matter of a woolly-minded physicist being recruited to revile Begin without any awareness of internal Zionist affairs. Einstein, himself a moderate Zionist, had been attacking revisionism, i.e. the movement which Begin now leads and which has always been the most militarist and rightist element in Zionism, militaristic and rightist element in Zionism, at least as far back as 1935. Why? A moderate Zionist like Einstein could, in 1935, point to the following characteristics of the revisionists. I'm going to sum up the basics of this before proceeding with Coburn's text here, so you get some idea of just what Coburn is talking about before we get into it, because there's a lot of information presented here, and lest some of it go by you, I'd like to give you basically two chances to pick this up. Now, basically, the Beitarim, spelled B-E-T-A-R-I-M, or the revisionist Zionists, were an explicit fascist wing in the Zionist movement. That is to say, the international movement to get all of the Jews, or most Jews, to return to their biblical homeland of Palestine. Okay? Now, basically, the Beitarim, or revisionist Zionists, represented a fascist element within the Zionist movement. And among the things they did, they basically wore brown shirt uniforms. They associated and, in fact, took military training from Mussolini's naval cadets. Basically, they had a training school set up in Italy under the auspices of Il Duce, and basically they received military training at this school. They were reviewed by Mussolini himself, and they gave the fascist salute. They sang the Italian fascist anthem, and their leader, a fellow by the name of Jabotinsky at that time, made it very clear that they were doing this because they felt had a strong affinity with the organization. They did not associate with Mussolini's fascists out of any felt sense of, basically because they felt obliged to in any way. They associated with Mussolini because they enjoyed his political views, and they felt to themselves to be affiliated with those kinds of views. And it's interesting that the Beitarim basically saw Zionism as the embodiment of the inherent superiority, what they felt to be the inherent superiority of light-skinned peoples over dark-skinned peoples. In other words, they saw the the rise to power, one might say, of the Jews in the Middle East as basically a manifestation of some form of racial superiority. They were particularly supportive of Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia, which they saw as a similar sort of phenomenon. In other words, they saw the Italians conquering the Ethiopians as a manifestation of the racial doctrine which they believed in, which was, as I said, explicitly racist and explicitly fascist. And it's worth noting, too, that the Beitarim did not work against the anti-Semitic regime of Poland. Rather, they encouraged Jews to travel to the Middle East. So keep in mind all the things I just mentioned. I'm going to read the actual text in which Coburn presents this information. Now, bear in mind that Coburn's information, in turn, comes from an article, a letter, I should say, written to the New York Times by Albert Einstein, among others, in 1948. Continuing here with Coburn's accounting of the fascist wing within the Zionist movement, that is to say, the Beitarim. Coburn writes, "A moderate Zionist like Einstein could in 1935 point to the following characteristics of the revisionists. They had brown shirt uniforms. They had a naval training school in Civitavecchia from 1934 to 1937 set up by Mussolini. In 1936, revisionist cadets, known as Beitarim, were reviewed by Il Duce himself. The March 1936 issue of L'Idea Sionistica describes the ceremonies inaugurating the new headquarters. The Beitarim commander ordered the triple chant, Vive l'Italia, vive il re, and vive il Duce. In other words, long live Italy, long live the king, long live il Duce, Mussolini. After which the Beitarim lustily sang the Italian fascist anthem. The revisionist leader, Vladimir Jabotinsky, deliberately stressed that it had not been necessary to have the school in Mussolini's Italy, where they were trained by the blackshirts. It had been a matter of choice. Einstein, or any well-informed political person, could have quoted the financial director of the revisionist movement, Wolfgang von Wiesel, last name V-O-N-W-E-I-S-L, a good friend of Begin, as saying, as reported by a London Zionist paper World Jewry for June 12, 1936, that, quote, although opinions among the revisionists varied, in general they sympathized with fascism. He personally was a supporter of fascism, and he rejoiced at the victory of fascist Italy in Abyssinia as a triumph of the white races against the black. Where was Begin in all of this? Begin was the fire-eater of the revisionists, one of the most militarist-minded. Jabotinsky found his ranting to be, quote, the useless screeching of a door, unquote. In 1939, Begin became head of the Polish Beitar. The revisionist Irgun was being trained in Poland at Zakopane by the anti-Semitic Polish army in explosives, underground methods, and so forth. In return for this instruction, revisionists told the Jews of Poland not to struggle against the anti-Semitic regime, but to pack up and leave for Palestine. Of course, the overwhelming majority rejected. Begin escaped from Warsaw in September of 1939 in the company of his close friend Nathan Yellin Moore, last name Yellin-Mor, editor of one of the revisionist Warsaw newspapers. Fleeing to Lithuania, Begin was imprisoned by the Soviet secret police, sent to Siberia, and only reached Palestine in 1942. Yellin Moore arrived well before Begin and joined the so-called Stern Gang, unquote, a split-off from the Irgun. The Irgun, by the way, was a underground paramilitary organization conducting, paramilitary or terrorist activities, depending on your ideological orientation or which side you were on, in Palestine before, during, and after World War II. Continuing here with Coburn's account, in 1941, Begin was one of the couriers for the Stern Gang's proposal for a wartime alliance with Hitler's Germany, portions of which follow. The following document was found after the war in the files of the German embassy in Ankara, and is quoted in full in German in David Yisraeli's Hebrew PhD thesis, The Palestine Problem in German Politics, 1889 to 1945. It is quoted and discussed against the context of the entire period in Leni Brenner's forthcoming Zionism in the Age of the Dictators. The German memorandum on the document is dated January 11, 1941. At this point, Avraham Stern called his movement the real Irgun Zwei Leumi, or National Military Organization, abbreviated NMO. I'm not going to go into the text of this memorandum right at this point. It basically is sort of typically turgid fascist prose, but it makes very clear that the NMO, the real Irgun Zwei Leumi, the National Military Organization, believed very strongly that they felt a strong affiliation with Nazi Germany, and that basically they saw Nazi Germany's policies towards the Jews as being consistent with their own. In other words, they saw German racialism as being beneficial to Zionism, and they sought a pattern of cooperation whereby the Third Reich would basically help them get the Jews out of, get German Jews out of Germany and into Palestine, and they in return would support the Third Reich's foreign policy goals. In particular, the so-called Stern Gang, the NMO, was very much preoccupied with attempting to undermine the British, basically undermine Britain's Middle East empire, which of course the Germans coveted. So it was in the interest not only of the Nazis to weaken Britain's Mideast Empire, but also of the Zionists as well, and they cooperated, at least to a certain extent, toward that end.
And again, from Miscellaneous Archive Show M30. I would note that the link between Italian fascism and the Likud party, the heir to the Beitar, is not something in the distant past. We are now going to go to an excerpt of For the Record program number 94, A Look at Global Fascism. This was recorded on May 5th of 1998, and in an article from the Searchlight magazine, a British anti-fascist publication, we're going to hear about the Likud sending a representative, a man named Udi Cohen, to the Congress, the National Congress of the Alleanza Nazionale of Gianfranco Fini. His AN party were the direct successors to Mussolini's Fascisti. And in addition to Udi Cohen, you're going to hear about Bob Young, a seated Republican member of the House of Representatives who also attended the Congress of the Alleanza Nazionale. And in that Republican, Likud, Alleanza Nazionale liaison, I think we are in a position to better understand the Boehner, Netanyahu, Likud liaison that we are looking at right now. As we have looked at in the past, there is an entire branch of the Republican Party, its ethnic outreach organization, which is literally evolved from the Third Reich. So again, from May 5th of 1998 and For the Record 94, here is an excerpt about the historical evolution of the Italian fascist Likud liaison.
There are a number of significant things about the recent Congress of the AN in Verona. I want to once again stress the similarity in the fascist rhetoric that the AN is adopting to the rhetoric of the Republican Party and the right wing in the United States. And I also want to stress that present at this Congress, again, the official Congress of the Italian Fascist Party in Verona, two of the people in attendance were U.S. member of the House of Representatives Bob Young of the Republican Party, and Udi Cohen from Israel, a member of the Likud party in Israel, that in turn is the heir to the fascist element within the Zionist movement, about which we will have more to say in a minute. This particular article is entitled Likud Greets Fini's Fascist Congress, and it concerns, among other things, U.S. Republican Representative Bob Young and Udi Cohen representing their respective parties at this fascist Congress. The article reads in part, "It was the, quote, new, unquote, face of Italian fascism which dominated the official proceedings of the fascist Alleanza Nazionale's three-day assembly in Verona in February. More than 2,000 AN members and supporters attended, many personally invited and representing a cross-section of Italian business and industry. Gianfranco Fini, leader of the AN, was reportedly pleased with the results. Well to the fore in shaping both presentation and content was Domenico Fisichella, F-I-S-I-C-H-E-L-L-A, one of Fini's key strategists. His role in the AN has become increasingly prominent as his leader tries to replace the AN's black shirt image with a more respectable white-shirted one. Since the purge that took place at the AN's inaugural Congress at Fiuggi in January of 1995, Fini has more than doubled the electoral support commanded by his party's successor, the openly fascist MSI. He's been able to mobilize up to 100,000 supporters onto the streets and is well on his way to establishing himself as the leader of the Italian right. Fisichella, a former Christian Democrat, has laid the basis for the AN's political respray by wrapping traditional fascism in terms such as the crisis of the Italian birth rate, unquote, the decline of patriotic values, unquote, decaying multi-ethnicity, unquote, and the crumbling Tower of Babel of pluriculture." Unquote. And again, note the similarity between the rhetoric of the Italian Fascist Party and the Republican Party in the far right in the United States. Continuing, of that rhetoric, the article comments, "These concepts are echoed by Fini himself. He constantly refers to the dangers of one-worldism, unquote, by which he is referring to the supposed onslaught of immigration, unquote, from the Third World to Europe. Basing his arguments on the rising number of elderly people in Europe, coupled with falling birth rates among Europeans, Feeney appeals to fears that white, Catholic cultural values will be replaced by the alien values of a rising, non-white, immigrant population. The old racist propaganda, well packaged in bogus socio-cultural and economic jargon. It is armed with such ideas that Feeney wants to install the AN as Italy's biggest single political party. For his project to reach success, however, Feeney must fill two objectives. Having defeated and restrained internal opposition within the AN, he must neutralize his rivals on the fragmented Italian right, and he must win new allies abroad. The second aim shows sign of a breakthrough. Present in Verona were the U.S. Republican Congressman Bob Young, who compared Feeney's wisdom with that of former U.S. President Ronald Reagan, and Udi Cohen from the right-wing Likud party in Israel, who brought greetings from his party. By the way, again note that Bob Young, a Republican member of the House of Representatives, was there unofficially representing the Republican Party of the United States, and Udi Cohen was there officially representing the Likud party from Israel, and he communicated his party's greetings. Skipping down, while Young and Cohen were praising Feeney in Verona, Alleanza Nazionale delegates outside the auditorium were signing petitions calling for the release of the Nazi war criminal Erich Priebke. The AN paper Il Secolo was calling the supporters of the SS-installed Salo Republic defenders of Italian honor, unquote.
That begins from, for the record, 94, from May 5th of 1998. Members of the Israeli right wing have continued to network with European fascist elements. From the YNetNews.com blog of July 4th of 2011, an article by Eldad Eldad Beck, B-E-C-K, Deputy Minister Meets Neo-Nazi Millionaire, and it reads in part, Deputy Minister Ayub Ayoob Kara, K-A-R-A, met with Swedish-German millionaire Patrick Brinkmann, B-R-I-N-K-M-A-N-N, who has ties with German neo-Nazi groups in Berlin over the weekend, Yedioth Ahronoth reported this, Y-E-D-I-O-T-H-A-H-R-O-N-O-T-H. Brinkmann, who is trying to establish a far-right anti-Islamic party in Germany, claims he is not an anti-Semite. However, his previous close contacts with the German neo-Nazi party, NPD, and his past membership in another neo-Nazi party raise questions regarding his ideology. Brinkmann, 44, made his fortune in the Swedish real estate business in the 1980s before becoming mixed in tax problems in his home country. As legal battles were going on, he used the majority of his finances for the establishment of two research foundations, which became closely affiliated with far-right and neo-Nazi elements in Germany. Several months ago, Ayub Kara met with Austrian Freedom Party leader Heinz Christian Strache, S-T-R-A-C-H-E, who was once active in neo-Nazi groups. And Israeli right-wingers are also networking with Russian fascists as well. From the Little Green Footballs blog of July 14th of 2011, The Unholy Alliance, How Israeli Wingnuts Befriended Russian Hitlerophiles by Sergei Romanov, R-O-M-A-N-O-V, subtitled Russian Nationalists Meet in Israel with Right-Wing Zionists, and it reads in part, One of the leaders of Russia's National Democratic Alliance visited Israel together with his colleagues at the invitation of religious right-wing Zionists came to the conclusion that the two political forces have a lot in common, skipping down. Since last week in Israel, there is a group of moderate ethnic Russian nationalists from Russia arrived here at the invitation of the religious right bloc Ehud Ha-Leumi, or National Unity. The leaders of an interregional public association of the National Democratic Alliance, established in March of 2010, made several trips to the Holy Land, visited the Knesset, parenthetically the Israeli parliament, and the memorial complex Yad Vashem. Following the visit, co-chairman of the movement Ilya Lazarenko came to the conclusion that the Russian nationalists and right-wing Zionists have much in common. Quote, We are very much in common, and first of all, rejection of violent Islamism, which is a threat to civilization, he said to the portal IsRus, I-Z-R-U-S. We also have some ideological overlap associated with the objectives of nation building and its operation, unquote. I would also note that there was actually an alliance before World War II between elements of the Zionist movement and the SS before the final solution to the Jewish problem, unquote, in which, of course, European Jewry were exterminated. Elements of the Zionist movement and the Haganah and the SS and its intelligence service, the SD, or Sicherheitsdienst, found common ground in promoting Jewish emigration from Germany to what was known at the time as Palestine. One of the key names here is Otto von Bolsing, whose protege, Helena von Damm, basically picked all of the people from whom, drew up the lists of personnel from which Ronald Reagan made all of his cabinet appointments. And I would also note that another of the people, another of the SD officers who affected the Haganah-SS alliance was none other than Adolf Eichmann himself. Once again, from Miscellaneous Archive Show M30 from September of 1983.
However, it's interesting to note that there was an actual working pattern of cooperation established between the SS and the Haganah, one of the main Zionist organizations, and that basically both the Haganah and the SS were working together for some time to promote the policy of Jewish emigration to Israel. And we're going to take a look at this in just a second. Now, the information I'm going to present here comes from a book called The Order of the Death's Head, The Story of Hitler's SS. And The Order of the Death's Head was authored by a German anti-fascist writer named Heinz Hoene, whose last name is spelled H-O-H-N-E. And Hoene's The Order of the Death's Head was published in paperback by Ballantine Books, and its first copyright is 1966. And in The Order of the Death's Head, Hoene describes the policy of the SS towards the Jews, the pre-final solution attitude, before the Nazis came up with the idea, and which, of course, they put into practice of exterminating the Jews, gassing them in the concentration camps. Basically, the Nazis worked to promote Jewish immigration to Palestine, and basically they sought to do a couple of things through this. First of all, they wanted to get all the Jews out of Germany, which, of course, is one of their main goals since they were profoundly anti-Semitic. Secondly, and not unimportantly, they sought to drive a wedge, as I said before, into Britain's Mideast Empire, thereby weakening it. And, of course, the Nazis hoped to basically take over Britain's Middle East holdings eventually. And they saw the growing Jewish state in the Middle East as a strong wedge to help out that particular policy aim of the Third Reich. And as Hoene points out here in The Order of the Death's Head, apparently Zionist elements in Germany also found, initially, many of them found the racist policies of the Third Reich and Hitler to be beneficial to their situation because they felt it would stimulate Jewish immigration to Palestine. And so they were initially, many elements of the German Zionist community were rather sympathetic, if not sympathetic to Nazism in and of itself, saw it as a beneficial thing for them, and so they didn't argue against it. This is delineated in The Order of the Death's Head by Hoene as follows. For the Jewish nationalists, the prospect was tempting. Under the pressure of German racialism and with its assistance, the Zionist ideal might win that victory denied it in the humanitarian and democratic atmosphere of the Weimar Republic. If both the Zionists and the National Socialists regarded race and nationhood as universally valid, some common ground must be discoverable between the two. As early as the 13th of June, 1933, the Jüdische Rundschau had come out into the open, quote, Zionism recognizes the existence of a Jewish problem and desires a far-reaching and constructive solution. For this purpose, Zionism wishes to obtain the assistance of all peoples, whether pro- or anti-Jewish, because in its view, we are dealing here with a concrete rather than a sentimental problem and in the solution of which all peoples are interested. Next, Hoene goes on to describe an SS man named von Mildenstein's work in promoting this active cooperation between Zionist elements in Germany and the Third Reich. And apparently the efforts on the part of Mildenstein were quite successful, and there the official SS policy to the Jews changed from one of diehard and all-encompassing anti-Semitism to one of open sympathy for Zionist elements in Germany. This is just, and interestingly enough, the SS apparently even provided strong logistical support to training centers for Jewish youth to be sent to work in the kibbutzim in the Middle East, the collective agricultural developments in Palestine. This pattern of cooperation between the SS and German Zionists is basically presented here by Hoene as follows. Keep in mind now, von Mildenstein is the SS man in charge of Jewish affairs at this point in the development of the Third Reich. At this point, von Mildenstein stepped in. The task of the SD, by the way, the SD is the SS Intelligence Service, beginning again. The task of the SD, he argued, was to turn the German assimilated Jews back into conscious Jews, to promote dissimilation in order to awaken in the breasts of the largest possible number of Jews the urge to go to Palestine, the only country open at the time to large-scale Jewish immigration. Himmler seized on Mildenstein's plan and set him to work. Within the SD Hauptamt, Mildenstein set up a Jewish desk entitled 2112. A period of SS Jewish policy began in which, according to Hans Lahm, last name L-A-M-M, quote, the adoption or affectation of a pro-Zionist attitude was in order, unquote. This new SS policy made its first appearance in the columns of the Schwarze Corps. In place of the paper's anti-Jewish tirades, references began to appear to the sensible, totally unsentimental Jew of the Zionist movement. The paper forecast, quote, the time cannot be far distant when Palestine will again be able to accept its sons who have been lost to it for over 1,000 years. Our good wishes, together with our official goodwill, go with them. Although Jewish emigration to Palestine was officially the responsibility of the Gestapo and the Reich Ministry of the Interior, the SD now began to force the pace. Between 1933 and 1937, 24,000 Jews had left for Palestine. The SD now increased its pressure upon those still willing to emigrate. Von Mildenstein gave all possible support to the Zionist organization's retraining camps, where young Jews were trained for the farm work which they would have to do in Palestine's kibbutzim. He kept close watch on the work of the Zionists and maintained large-scale maps in his office showing the progress of Zionism among German Jewry. Well, the final element that I'd like to present to you basically concerns the close affiliation and, in fact, a working relationship that was established between the SS and specifically the SD, the Sicherheitsdienst, and the Haganah, which was basically a Zionist defense organization which incorporated, among other things, a very effective and important worldwide Zionist espionage system. Okay? Basically, it was sort of, among other things, the Zionist intelligence wing. And basically, a working relationship was established here between the SS and a Haganah man named Pavel Polkesh, last name P-O-L-K-E-S. Apparently, Polkesh was able to make contact with several of the SS leaders in charge of Jewish matters, notably Adolf Eichmann, later executed for his part in exterminating European Jews. And basically, Polkesh, Eichmann, and another SS man named Albert Hagen, at that point Eichmann's superior, were put in contact with Pavel Polkesh by a guy named Otto von Bolschwing. Now, Otto von Bolschwing is a fellow we're going to talk about at some length in the future on Hard Rain. Basically, he was also at one point Adolf Eichmann's superior in administering the Jewish affairs for the SS, and von Bolschwing later went on to become head of Reinhard Gehlen's North American operation. You recall that Gehlen was Hitler's chief of intelligence for the Eastern Front, who then jumped with his entire organization to the CIA, and then in turn to NATO, and finally to West Germany, where Gehlen's organization, the organization he founded, is the West German Intelligence Service to this day. Okay, and Otto von Bolschwing, the fellow who formed the contact between the Haganah and the SS, became head of Gehlen's entire North American operation. Okay, beginning here with Hoene's account of the working relationship established between Pavel Polkesh, acting on behalf of the Haganah and the SS, Hoene writes as follows. Mere control of the Zionists in Germany, however, did not satisfy Hagen and Eichmann. If they were really to estimate the chances of formation of a Jewish state, they had to force their way into the nerve center of the Zionist movement itself. The opportunity to do so came via an old friend of von Mildenstein. This was Otto von Bolschwing, last name V-O-N-B-O-L-S-C-H-W-I-N-G-H, a party member, an SD informer, and an experienced salesman in the motor trade. Von Bolschwing was in contact with a group of Palestinian Germans who lined their pockets by certain extramural intelligence activities. Among them was Dr. Reichert, the German news agency's Jerusalem correspondent. Reichert, in turn, possessed contacts with one of the leaders of a secret Zionist organization, the Haganah, which, with the exception of the British Intelligence Service, fascinated the SD more than any other institution. Eichmann's comment on the Haganah in his 1936 brochure had been, quote, All parties and formations included in the Zionist World Organization are kept under observation by a central counter-espionage and supervisory office, which plays an extraordinarily important role in Jewish political life. This office is known as Haganah, translated self-defense. The Haganah was not only the Jewish settlers' military defense organization, but in addition, maintained a widespread espionage system. On the headquarters staff of this secret army, there was a chartered accountant named Fievel Polkesz, last name P-O-L-K-E-S, born in Poland on the 11th of September, 1900, who drew considerable sums for Dr. Reichert for occasional scraps of information. Polkesz carried the rank of commander in the Haganah, and according to Hagen, was responsible for, quote, running the entire self-defense organization of the Palestinian Jews. I'm going to repeat that last sentence. This fellow Polkesz, who worked with the SS, as we're going to see in a minute, quote, according to Albert Hagen, was responsible for running the entire self-defense organization of the Palestinian Jews. Now, the next section of Hona's text here basically delineates the contact between Polkesz, Eichmann, and Hagen, and basically indicates that Polkesz not only was willing to work with the SD, with the SS Intelligence Service, but basically that he was acting here in his capacity as an official representative of the Haganah, that basically the policy he was putting into effect represented official Haganah policy. Hona writes as follows. Section 2112 evinced interest in the Haganah commander, and in February 1937, Polkesz journeyed to Berlin. On the 26th of February, he and Eichmann met. On the first occasion, Eichmann entertained him at the Traube restaurant near the zoo. During the return match, Polkesz invited Eichmann to Palestine. Polkesz was, of course, no ordinary agent. His object, he explained to Eichmann, was to accelerate Jewish immigration into Palestine so that the Jews in their homeland might outnumber the Arabs. For this purpose, he was already working with the British and French secret services and was only too willing to cooperate with Hitler Germany. On the 17th of June, 1937, Eichmann's office noted, quote, he, Polkesz, was prepared, among other things, to give powerful support to German foreign policy interests in the Middle East, on condition that German currency regulations were relaxed for Jews emigrating to Palestine. Gradually, the SD realized that Polkesz had not made the journey to Berlin on his own initiative. He was patently representing the immigration policy of the Haganah. Eichmann minuted, quote, as a quid pro quo, the following assurances could be given to Polkesz. Pressure would be exerted upon the German Jewish settlers to place an obligation on all Jews emigrating from Germany to go to Palestine and not to any other country. Such a measure is completely in line with German interests, and preparatory steps have already been taken by the Gestapo. At 8:50 a.m. on the 26th of September, 1937, Eichmann and Hagen boarded a train and set off to crown these first cautious steps toward an SS-Haganah alliance.
That again from Miscellaneous Archives Show M30 from September of 1983. There's also a Miscellaneous Archives Show talking about elements of the Beitar, collaborating with the FBI and the COINTELPRO program as well. Elements that were grouped around the former reactionary Rabbi Meir Kahane. There is another generally poorly documented fascist Zionist link that I think might be the most important, and that is the development of what I call Bormann Jews. And we can only guess just how much influence the massive Bormann capital network wields within a tiny country like Israel. This is an excerpt from For the Record program number 305, in turn excerpting the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, which is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website.
Since the founding of Israel, the Federal Republic of Germany had paid out 85.3 billion marks by the end of 1977 to survivors of the Holocaust. East Germany ignores any such liability. From South America, where payment must be made with subtlety, the Bormann Organization has made a substantial contribution. It has drawn many of the brightest Jewish businessmen into a participatory role in the development of many of its corporations, and many of these Jews share their prosperity most generously with Israel. If their proposals are sound, they are even provided with a specially dispensed venture capital fund. I spoke with one Jewish businessman in Hartford, Connecticut. He had arrived there quite unknown several years before our conversation, but with Bormann money as his leverage. Today, he is more than a millionaire, a quiet leader in the community with a certain share of his profits earmarked, as always, for his venture capital benefactors. This has taken place in many other instances across America and demonstrates how Bormann's people operate in the contemporary commercial world, in contrast to the fanciful nonsense with which Nazis are described in so much, quote, literature, unquote. So much emphasis is placed on select Jewish participation in Bormann companies that when Adolf Eichmann was seized and taken to Tel Aviv to stand trial, it produced a shockwave in the Jewish and German communities of Buenos Aires. Jewish leaders informed the Israeli authorities in no uncertain terms that this must never happen again, because a repetition would permanently rupture relations with the Germans of Latin America, as well as with the Bormann organization, and cut off the flow of Jewish money to Israel. It never happened again, and the pursuit of Bormann quieted down at the request of these Jewish leaders. He is residing in an Argentinian safe haven protected by the most efficient German infrastructure in history, as well as by all those whose prosperity depends on his well-being. Personal invitation is the only way to reach him. A revealing insight into this international financial and industrial network was given me by a member of the Bormann organization residing in West Germany. Meyer Lansky, he said, the financial advisor to the Las Vegas-Miami underworld, sent a message to Bormann through my West German SS contact. Lansky promised that if he received a piece of Bormann's action, he would keep the Israeli agents off Bormann's back. Quote, "I have a very good relation with the Israeli secret police," was his claim. Unquote. Although he was to be kicked out, "I have a very good relation with the Israeli secret police," unquote, was his claim, although he was to be kicked out of Israel later when his presence became too noted, and also at the urging of Bormann's security chief in South America. At the time, Lansky was in the penthouse suite of Jerusalem's King David Hotel, in which he owned stock. He had fled to Israel to evade a U.S. federal warrant for his arrest. He sent his message to Bormann through his bagman in Switzerland, John Pullman, also wanted in the United States on a federal warrant. Lansky told Pullman to make this offer, quote, "which he can't refuse," unquote. The offer was forwarded to Buenos Aires, where it was greeted with laughter. When the laughter died down, it was replaced with action. Meyer Lansky was evicted from Israel and was told by Swiss authorities to stay out of their country, so he flew to South America. There, he offered any president who would give him asylum a cool $1 million in cash. He was turned down everywhere and had to continue his flight to Miami, where U.S. Marshals, alerted, were waiting to take him into custody. The Bormann organization has the ultimate in clout and substance, and no one can tamper with it. I have been told, quote, "you cannot push these people. If you do, it can be extremely risky," unquote. Knowing their heritage, I take this statement at face value.
That again from For the Record program number 305, recorded in 1997, and in turn, those excerpts were from the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. We have a few minutes left, and I think that I'm going to attempt to do something. Probably will not work, but as I mentioned at the top of the program, most people simply are not aware of the history of the Arab-Israeli conflict. It goes back to World War I and involves things that people just don't get told about. Part of the problem is that the Arabs have oil, at least many of the Arab countries do, and even though the price of oil is falling precipitously, Saudi Arabia, which has the world's largest oil reserves and has basically backed the Palestinian National Movement since the end of World War II, they have tremendous investments in various corporations. So too do other Arab countries. And ultimately, political power is derivative of corporate economic power. And the Arabs have a tremendous amount of that, and the Israelis don't, because the Arabs have oil and Israel doesn't. One does not, for example, generally think about the Kuwaiti Investment Authority, but they own a significant amount of stock in many corporations that produce many of the brand names that people are familiar with. Also, the academic community is also heavily subsidized by the Arabs. For example, at the University of Southern California, Saudi Arabia has set up a major Institute for Middle Eastern Studies. Prince al-Walid has done the same thing at places like Harvard University and also Georgetown University as well. The Underground Reich, even though it has its tentacles into Israel, as we have seen, it is basically supportive of the Arabs and looks ultimately to the Arabs as proxy warriors to finish the job and wipe out Israel and also the Jewish communities in the U.S. That is something of a transition point to discussion. I'm going to do my best to give a thumbnail synopsis of the discussion. Really, we should start with World War One, as the warring powers were grinding each other down in the First World War. Both Germany and Britain turned to the tactic of using proxy warriors in order to undermine the other. The Ottoman Empire was allied with Imperial Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire in World War One. A German intelligence officer named Max von Oppenheim originated an idea of using jihad and the Ottoman Empire, which was a theocracy, in order to get Muslims worldwide to fight on behalf of the Central Powers, that is to say, Austria-Hungary, and Germany. That worked up to a point. Remember that the British Empire, including their most important imperial holding of India, had a very large Muslim population. If the Ottoman Empire had successfully been able to lure the world's Muslims or exhort the world's Muslims into waging jihad on behalf of the Central Powers, it might have worked. It did not. Britain resorted to the same idea. Many people may have seen the movie Lawrence of Arabia. T.E. Lawrence basically was able to successfully mobilize the Arabs into a guerrilla war against the Ottoman Empire and the Turks. They made promises to King Faisal that they would in turn grant the Arabs autonomy after the defeat of the Ottoman Empire. They betrayed the Arabs. And in turn, Lord Balfour also made a similar promise to Jews in the Middle East and elsewhere in exchange for a promise of British recognition and international recognition of a Jewish state, a Jewish homeland in the Middle East. Jews would fight on behalf of Great Britain and the Allies in World War One. At the end of World War One, Britain betrayed the Jews just as they did the Arabs. As a result of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, basically Britain and France carved up what had been the Middle East and divided those imperial powers, I should say what had been the Ottoman Empire, and carved up those territories for themselves. One of the things that was ignored was the fact that is ignored is the Treaty of San Remo of 1920. One of the provisions of that was that basically Jews could settle anywhere in what is now known as the West Bank, although I am personally very much opposed to the unbridled Israeli settlements in the West Bank. They are not technically speaking illegal under international law. However, the Israelis who are normally a very sophisticated people never make any reference to the Treaty of San Remo of 1920. It was never repealed. It simply was ignored. If they would do that, they might have a better case. It's quite curious because the Israelis are in many ways a very sophisticated people, and yet they have no PR sense whatsoever. Their unbridled policy of expanding settlements in the West Bank, though not technically speaking illegal under international law, is not practical from a diplomatic standpoint. And if they would simply recognize that they should stop doing that. And again, fewer than one in six American Jews is supportive of the expansion of the settlements. It would be something akin to a diplomatic jujitsu move. They would have a tremendous amount of diplomatic leverage, but they don't do that. They just keep approving the settlements willy-nilly, which is unbelievably stupid from a public relations and diplomatic standpoint. Now, back to World War One. The Ottoman Empire maintained control in that part of their empire by basically using the influence of three clans. The Arab peoples were basically in a state of clan division or organization. The main clans were the Hashemites, who had control over the Mecca and Medina, the two most holy sites in Islam. The Najashidi have a lot of influence in Jerusalem, the third most influential site in Islam. And the Husseini clan, H-U-S-S-E-I-N-I, had influence in all three, Mecca, Medina, and Jerusalem. For that reason, the Ottoman Empire generally elevated the Husseini clan to a position of primacy. When the British took over that part of the old Ottoman Empire, they basically did the same thing. They betrayed both the Arabs and King Faisal and the Jews, and they elevated the Husseini clan to a position of primacy, and a guy named Haj Amin al-Husseini became the leader of the Palestinian National Movement. That guy basically ultimately became a general in the Waffen-SS, and he is identified with genocide throughout his career. He began as an officer in the Turkish army in World War I that pursued genocidal policies towards the Armenians. Then he began fomenting anti-Jewish pogroms in the Middle East. Then he allied with Nazi Germany, and he also did broadcasts for the Japanese. For example, he was supportive of the Suk Ching massacres. The Japanese took advantage of Islamist sentiment in Asia, in countries where there were Muslim majorities and Chinese minorities, and whereas the Chinese both educated their children and practiced birth control, the Muslim majorities in those countries did neither, and so not surprisingly, the Muslim majorities got stuck in a cycle of poverty. They were deeply resentful of the Chinese minorities. The Japanese pursued a murderous policy toward the Chinese minorities. The Chinese are often called the Jews of Asia for that reason. Haj Amin al-Husseini pursued basically broadcasts on behalf of the Suk Ching massacres. He then hooked up with the Muslim Brotherhood after World War II, after helping to form Waffen-SS formations for the Third Reich. And again, he was a general in the Waffen-SS. He hooked up with the Muslim Brotherhood, and one of his proteges was Yasser Arafat. Arafat was also a protege of Otto Skorzeny, the SS commando and Odessa Weaver, and a key Galen agent in the post-World War II period. There were a series of wars beginning in 1948. Israel won all of them militarily, and the Arabs lost all of them. And that is pretty much where we stand now. After the 1967 war, the Israelis offered to abandon all of the occupied territories in exchange for a guarantee of peace. They were rebuffed, and that's where things stand now. And there's more we could talk about. However, we are almost out of time. And again, sadly, we don't get told about these things, and this is a very complex situation. I am extremely pessimistic that it will ever work out properly. We don't get told, for example, about how Sua and Yasser Arafat came to control a billion-dollar slush fund, whereas most Palestinians have an annual income of $1,500 a year per family, and they have large families. And we don't get told about the continued, what we've been talking about here, the continued alliance between international fascism and the fascist element within the Zionist movement, in particular the fascist elements in the Republican Party, which are dominant, and the Likud and other elements. Again, this may not work, but we are all out of time. This concludes, for the record, 834 Compendium of Fascist Connections to the Zionist Movement. This has been recorded on February 8th of 2015. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.